interned back home in Tokyo. And while I was there, I realized that every other IP-related seminar or conference was related to how disappointed Japanese legal scholars were by the fact that the copyright amendment passed last year in 2012 by adapting the concept of fair use. And it was really interesting to see that the argument around adapting fair use concept was almost always accompanied by a discussion concerning how to save manga and anime industry, which is said to be flourishing thanks to the fan-based activities of creating derivative work. Even though those activities are considered to be copyright infringement under the current Copyright Act. So I started learning whether there are any provisions under current law that could be extended or interpreted to cover such derivative works. And I participated in some seminars and I learned the background. So I wanted to write a paper on this issue. It seems interesting to me that when you look at the prominence of manga and anime industry in Japan, you can say that idea that imperfect protection of intellectual property yields underproduction of intellectual property, or more protection leads to more authorship, is not necessarily true. So these fan-based activities have been tacitly allowed by copyright holders and left in a legally gray area so far. But this might have to change because of the TPP, because it might make such activities subject to criminal prosecution without a formal complaint by a copyright holder in the future, very soon probably. Especially looking at the doujinshi or fan magazine market, my paper argues that Japanese Copyright Act should adopt a general provision general provision of fair use into the Japanese Copyright Act, like the U.S. version. Even though to do that, you have to consider several things. Like compatibility with the international law, like the Berne Convention, or the Japanese civil law system, or that we do not have case laws so far to use to interpret what can be called fair use. So basically, this is what I'm talking about. In my paper. Oh, and then I got the comment from Professor Friedman that if copyright holder thinks he or she benefits from fan-based activities, then a fair use exception is unnecessary because copyright holder will simply permit them. There are several already implemented legislative schemes implemented by the industry on its own, which includes and suggests copyright holders give permission to doujinshi creators in general, or something like Creative Commons like copyright mark, which modifies default all rights reserved to some rights reserved, and then give permission to these derivative works. And license of the day system, which has gradually been established in the 1960s by the organizer of Wonder Festival, which is a spot market for figures and costumes created based on anime and manga, to give merchandising license from the copyright holders only during that event at the venue. But there are some argument against these things because copyright holders, especially big publishers, are not willing to give official permission to the doujinshi industry in general, even though they do recognize positive effects of doujinshi industry. And giving individual permission to each creation is not very realistic given the enormous number of existing doujinshi creators and their works. And also, there are not really desirable creations, like transforming the original work into so-called erotic parodies or parodies involving violence or very radical, like creating like best ending of certain series and then publish it. And also, it was easier to adapt license of the day system for figures and costumes, conventions, because they tend to see value of the work in creating work that look exactly like the character's original work, rather than deviating from them. Also, what they fear is now, because of the TPP, the chilling effect of criminal prosecution. So I think adopting various concepts in the general provision would be the best way to go for Japanese programs.
Comments? Very good.
I have a quick question. My memory, I think you just said it, is that in Japan, in copyright, there are actually criminal, is this the criminal charges can be filed in copyright, it's not just a civil penalty?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Well, you know, right now, yes, it's a criminal prosecution, but with the formal complaint by the copyright holder.
But didn't you say that the law had been amended or they proposed amending it so it didn't require a complaint by the holder?
The law was amended not to the TPP, if the TPP will be enforced, then the law probably will be that there will be no requirement of formal.
But that's not yet the law.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet. But for the illegal downloading, that was the new law last year.
Yeah. I feel like that makes your argument a lot stronger, that there can be these criminal penalties associated mm-hmm. with violating copyright. Mm-hmm. If it was just an issue of, well, they aren't going to be penalized unless the copyright holder goes after them, unless the copyright holder thinks they're having a negative effect.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not a copyright holder would go after them when there was a positive effect doesn't have as much weight if there's also a potential criminal sanction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that makes sure.
But they're really two different issues. That is, even with criminal sanctions, if you're reasonably sure the copyright holder won't go after you, that would be a protection. But that doesn't work once the official has been do it.
Right.
And in addition, if the only sanction is actual damages,
mm-hmm.
then it's usually not going to be worth going after you. And if they go after you, pay them a little bit of money, but it's not a very serious
mm-hmm.
cost. I guess part of the question that I wondered about was you seem to be simultaneously arguing that the copyright holders benefit by this activity, and therefore an interpretation of fair use that was in effect a blanket license would be a good thing, and yet that the copyright holders would not be willing to give a blanket license. And it doesn't seem to me that that's consistent, that if it's really true, as you seem to think, that on net your proposed interpretation of fair use benefits the copyright holders, then your argument, well, they wouldn't give a license because there are some things they want to stop, can't be right, can it?
Mm-hmm.
You see the problem?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I see the problem, yeah.
Because it seems to me that the license does get around the problem of government enforcement, because they aren't going to enforce copyright violation if it's not violating, and it's not violating if the copyright holder is given a general license, right? Isn't that right? That is, presumably under Japanese law,
mm-hmm.
if I'm the publisher of a manga, I could say I give a license to anyone making any of the following uses.
Mm-hmm.
You can't copy my manga, but you can make any derivative work you like. That would be enforceable, right?
I guess so, yes. But I guess the question is that maximize the creativity or productivity, I guess.
Why wouldn't that that would seem to achieve your objective for the culture, and why doesn't it also achieve your objective for the copyright holder? That is one of the things that isn't entirely clear is if you think there's a real conflict between what best benefits Japanese culture and what best benefits copyright holders. Because if there's no conflict, then it doesn't seem as though the law matters very much. Whereas if there is a conflict, then your interpretation pushes one answer and the other interpretation pushes the other. No?
I guess so.
And you wanted, it wasn't entirely clear, but you want a definition of fair use that's substantially broader than the U.S. definition or not?
Well, I guess like what I wanted to suggest was that something similar to U.S. law. Like the one...
do you think that under U.S. law, most of what you're describing would not be considered derivative works and in violation?
My understanding is it's a parody. It's considered as like a transformative work.
And the question is what counts as parody. Suppose, take standard fan fiction, all right? Suppose I write some short stories in which the Star Trek characters are my characters. So I'm writing short stories in the Star Trek universe. They aren't making fun of the Star Trek universe. They're just taking that setting and doing my own stories. If I correctly understand U.S. law, I am infringing copyright. The copyright holder may choose to ignore it, and I think mostly do ignore it. But I think they could. Am I wrong? The other people may know more about it. But if I understand you correctly, that's what a good deal of what you're describing is, isn't it? So it sounds as though what you really want is a definition of fair use that's broader than the U.S. one. It sounds as though what you really want is to say that derivative works are not covered, or some wide category of derivative works are not covered. Isn't that right?
You are right, yeah. But I think, as I mentioned before, the compatibility with international law.
Well, that's part of what's intriguing me about this, is it's both your paper and the next paper, is that there are clearly situations where what a country would like to do and what other countries would like it to do are different in IP. And there are at least two different reasons for that. One of them, which you suggest at the beginning of your paper and then drop, is that the country is a net consumer of IP, not a net producer, in which case it would really prefer to be a free rider, all right? What the U.S. was until 1900 or so, what Taiwan was later. A different one is that even in terms of domestic people, the right IP rule for your country is different. So if you think about the Japanese case, if I understand you correctly, almost all the cases you're describing, the IP holders are themselves Japanese. So it's not a case of Japanese wanting to be able to infringe American copyrights without having to pay any money for it. It's a case of Japanese wanting to infringe Japanese copies without paying any money for it. So therefore, it's not entirely clear why the U.S. should care about that. Imagine that you're not changing Japanese law but negotiating the treaty. You ought to be able to say to the Americans, look, we want this loophole in the treaty. Doesn't affect you at all, and it promotes our culture. And is there any reason why the Americans should object to that? Assuming you can construct the loophole in a way that only...
Then in that case,
because that might be a different. Because part of what seems to me is raised by all of this, by both papers, is to what degree. Let me go back a step. My other seminars on legal systems very different from ours, and one of the subjects we discuss is legal systems where the law is not made by the legislature but by God, things like Jewish law and Islamic law. What do you do if you don't like the result? And the answer is you interpret around it. So that I like to claim that by the standards of the rabbis, every Supreme Court justice in history was a strict constructionist. If you look at how much they get around what the Torah actually says in order to get the law they want. And this is really an analogous issue, that to the extent you are constrained by treaty, how can you get the result you want by how you interpret the terms of the law? And you want to do it by interpreting fair use. And I don't think it'll work if all you want is U.S. fair use, because I don't think that covers the things you want, all the things you want to cover. Some of the Indians want to do it by interpreting invention, I think, and I guess the New Zealanders, if I understand that paper correctly. And I don't really know what the limits of doing that are. But I would have thought that it would be easier in the case, if I correctly read the Indian situation, what the Indians want to do is to infringe U.S. patents or European patents or whatever. And therefore, you can understand that the other countries involved might disapprove of that. Whereas it sounds as though you're trying to figure out how the Japanese can be allowed to infringe Japanese copyrights. And you would think that in principle, that's something that only the Japanese should care about. And therefore, that they ought to be able to either negotiate or interpret without anybody complaining, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
I guess so, yeah. But I guess between U.S. and Japan, the TPP agreement is that the U.S. would like to enforce more copyright protection in Japan.
And for U.S. copyrights. Why does the U.S. care about protection in Japan for Japanese copyrights?
Right, but that requires a change, like amendments in Japanese copyright law under the U.S. could not probably say that, you know, this covers only, you know, foreign copyright holders. And then this stuff.
Why couldn't you? Why is there anything in the current law that would prevent a different rule for domestic copyrights than for foreign copyrights? In particular, a weaker rule for domestic copyrights, which you would expect the foreigners wouldn't complain about.
Yeah, I thought that was the rule.
What?
You have to treat foreign copyrights as protected as your own. You can provide them with additional protection would be okay. In other words, you could afford stronger protection to foreign copyrights than to your own copyrights. It's the reverse.
That would seem to be a way around it. If, as you describe it, your whole problem involves Japanese intellectual property, that I don't know, I suppose there must be some Americans who make manga, but not very much, I think. Or anime. Lots of Americans consume it, I should say. This is presumably manga and anime must be all of the Japanese copyright exports, since that's popular in the U.S. as well. But so it sounds as though that may be an alternative way of doing what you want to do, to just say that we will have the ordinary rules for foreign copyrights, but in order to encourage Japanese culture and recognize the special nature of this part of Japanese culture, we will have a special rule saying that we have that basically derivative works of the following sort are not covered. So that would be a different one. Other people have comments, suggestions, stuff they want to do? Nobody else? Yeah.
I was just going to note that a couple days ago there was a new leak, the TPP, that you might want to take a look at. That WikiLeaks release.
Of a later draft?
Yeah, supposedly a later draft. I don't think it's
the whole draft that it shows what countries support.
That's what I was about to say. What's very cool about it is it shows you who's supporting a particular statement and who's opposing it. And so you can actually look and see where the U.S. and Japan differ or whether they're in agreement.
That would be
neat. To this.
It's a big deal because the U.S. is apparently differing from everyone on
everything. So is it clear? I'm curious in all of this. What is the leverage the U.S. has? There's the particular case that strikes me, which is not Japan and may or may not be India, is third world countries that produce almost no IP, or at least IP that anybody else is paying for, and therefore seem to be completely losers by enforcing these rules. And is it that the U.S. is implicitly saying we won't trade with you if you don't do this? Or is it the implication that we're really bribing their government with foreign aid to sign it? Do you think that's what?
Well, at least with the case with India was that basically the way the U.S. forced them to accept a lot of the TRIPS stuff with the WTO was India ended up, they were negotiating the treaty, and India at the same time happened to be going through a bout of inflation problems. And basically the U.S. refused to allow their IMF voter to vote for relief to a loan to help them with their inflation troubles. So they link two totally different, separate things together to force India to sign the obligations.
And that's interesting. So it wasn't really being a part of being the World Trade Organization. What do you know? What happened in other?
That's the only really big example that I sussed out.
Because even India isn't that clear a case, because India probably does produce some noticeable amount of of IP, but it's hard to believe that, you know, most of the sub-Saharan African countries are producing anything anybody else is licensing, and yet they're presumably going to be bound. Now, this is something that puzzled me for a very long time, the whole general issue of how you get agreement on intellectual property rules given the conflict of interest. Yeah?
The Hollywood exports are pretty significant.
Bollywood are, yeah, no, that's right. But also, I mean, I suspect there's probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there's, you know, stuff like software and pharmaceuticals and such where they're, I think, not as major a source as the U.S., but then this may still be a noticeable source. But on the other hand, India also, I think, produces a lot of generic pharmaceuticals for third world markets, and that's easier to do if you have weak. I mean, they can make it generic the day after it comes out if they have weak enough protection. All right, so I think you've finished your comments, and we have our next paper by our anonymous presenter. I should say, in my other seminar, in my other seminar, the reason one paper is being handed out physically rather than put on the web is because it's a paper about the American-Italian mafia. I think his reasons are not quite as strong.
No.
And again, please do remember that you are supposed to assume people have read your paper.
Okay.
I have been insufficiently ferocious in enforcing those terms of the arrangement. Oh. You've got to turn it on.
You want the room PC.
Okay. Thank you.
And we'll now take a
20 seconds to load up.
20 seconds, I
okay.
To turn it on, at least. That'll load you up.
All right, so just to help the conversation flow a little bit, I'm going to just give a brief outline of what the paper is and then a little bit about what I've kind of changed it to, both as a result of the comments and kind of the way my thinking happened to come across. So the big thing that you have to realize, and if you don't know much about it, is the paper focuses on the WTO, specifically the TRIPS agreement, component of the WTO accession process. And so I thought, you know, it might be useful to show a map of all the countries that are part of the WTO and not part of the WTO. Red is just the members that aren't, or the people that aren't in the WTO. Green is obviously full members. And then the blue are interestingly, or I thought interesting, countries that are represented in the WTO twice. They are members themselves, and then the EU is also a member of the WTO. And then the rest of the countries are just observers. So they don't get all the benefits, but they kind of sit in on the discussion. So why do developing countries join the WTO? Well, first of all, just some information that there's about 150 members in the WTO, and about two-thirds of them are developing countries. The interesting thing about this is that it has nothing to do with UN definitions for what a developing country is. Basically, you are independently determined to be a developing country when you accede to the WTO. And the only reason that I was able to find that, and this is directly actually from the WTO, that developing countries do join is they get preferential treatment in that they get the same reduction of tariffs that all the other WTO members receive. And in addition, often countries will give them even more preferential treatment. But to get that, they, again, have to be recognized as developing countries within the WTO. And then, of course, they receive technical assistance. This is especially important, not in IP questions, but more in agricultural goods that are traded across borders. Countries want to assure that the quality is similar across the member countries. So this is a good point for me to tell you guys, if you read my paper, how it's kind of changed. So I've kind of reoriented my paper to focus more on a prototypical example of a developing country who wants to determine whether or not it wants to join the WTO and what that means for its IP rights. The prototypical example that I kind of have been thinking about in my head for no particular reason is Kenya. It has a growing tech sector, and it's actually called the Silicon Safari. I'm not putting that in my paper. But yeah, they have startup funds, accelerators, et cetera, et cetera. And part of the reason that they are looking at this is because right now, essentially, their patent system is like a copyright here. Or I'm sorry, a trademark here, where you go register and you get it. It's like a stamp. There's no inspection, nothing. So they are not necessarily looking at changing their patent system, but I think they should. And so I've kind of written this paper to, or I've reoriented the paper to focus more on the different ways they could go. And I look at a couple examples, which I look at four examples of options they could take, and I kind of make a proposal at the end of what I think they should do. So in brief, basically the paper focuses on whether or not they should join the WTO and what the benefits costs are, although I don't spend much time focusing on the numbers, but I could talk a little bit about some numbers now. This is actually a question that I got from the professor on, that I got on my paper. But to be honest with you, it's kind of hard to find the numbers for some of these things. But I did find a report that was talking about how much in IP overall there is the fees that are taken from. And that's from a WTO report statistic from 2012, about $270 billion worldwide. Now that's traffic in both directions, both to the developing countries and out of the developing countries. I wasn't able to find numbers or even the direct statistics country by country about which direction the licensing and royalty fees are, although I imagine that they're mostly going from the developed world to the developing world. And the closest I was able to, the closest information I was able to find to kind of support that assertion is the last statistic down there, which is specific to the United States. And it's basically 15% of IP royalties flow to countries outside the US, EU and Japan. From the United States. But that's only of the United States, so it doesn't really reflect that $270 billion. I imagine a substantial amount of that is actually from India, which, as we discussed just a few minutes ago.
So those are royalties the U.S. pays to
developing countries.
Got it.
Right. And overall, I believe the number, the royalties that the U.S. does pay is around $37 billion. That's outflow. But most of that, I said, is to the EU and Japan. So I imagine that's Germany and Japan. But remember that these IP licenses are not just patents. They are also copyright. So take those statistics, which you will. So did anybody have questions on kind of the distinctions I drew between the four patent systems and how they kind of interpret TRIPS? I can talk about it a little bit, but I don't know if that fits within the requirements of that short
enough.
So Europe, I go through Europe, I go through India, New Zealand, and India. I basically point out that, and this paper focuses strictly on software, or computer program patents. So in that regard, the EPC and India's systems kind of reflect a similar idea. In fact, in some of the research I found, it said that there was quite a bit of drama in the Indian Parliament when it was found out that the main guy who wrote the section regarding computer patents literally lifted it from his research that he had done in Europe. So that was interesting, but I did not include that. But they all kind of have restrictions except for the United States, which is well known around the world for being the most liberal jurisdiction for computer program patents, in trying to limit software patents in some way. India and Europe have gone the per se route using that language, which...
Could you give an example? That was sort of puzzled me reading the paper, not being an expert on this.
Right.
What would be a patent application that would not qualify, and what would be one that would?
Yeah. So this is kind of the language that the EPC examiners look at when they're trying to examine this patentable subject matter. And so I did come up with an example because this is a good to talk about that. And so this is actually an example that I did find in some of the literature. And so if there was an application for a computer-related language analysis device, and the way this the application kind of spelled it out was that it was a computer-implemented method that used rule, like basically grammar rules to decipher the language. And the EPC, or I'm sorry, the EPC, the EPO, determined that this was, I had the notes on my phone, determined that this was not patentable subject matter. And the reason was that the technical character was not actually new before, above and beyond the prior art. So the computer analysis of rules is well known, but the combination of the hardware and the grammatical rules is what the invention is. And so as a computer program, it was not patentable for that reason. So it wasn't adding anything technical. So that was kind of the example that I found that I kind of...
And what would be one... And now what's one that would be?
Well, that's a more difficult question, isn't it? That's a good question.
Surely when your clients are going to be asking you in 10
years. Well, when a client comes to me, everything's patentable. that's a good question.
What if it's, like, baked into a hardware device to the point where it's not...
So, yeah, those could be patentable. And...
Are you saying that if we took that program mm-hmm. and burned it into ROMs,
yes.
and you had your little Star Trek interpreter with you, that it suddenly becomes patentable and it wasn't patentable before?
Actually, yeah. No, there is precedent within the examination procedure manuals that talk about basically if you integrate it with the hardware, then it becomes patentable. And it's because what they're actually trying to bar is pure software inventions. And so by integrating it with the hardware, you kind of, well, it's no longer a pure software.
How about if your invention is an idea? I'm thinking of the most important never patented invention in software, arguably, which is the spreadsheet.
Okay.
So suppose you have the first spreadsheet.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, I'm not copywriting my program, or maybe I'll do that separately. All I want to do is to patent the idea of the spreadsheet. Is that patentable under EPO or not?
The spreadsheet before...
The first spreadsheet.
Oh, the first spreadsheet. The paper spreadsheet.
No. The first computer spreadsheet. Oh. A computer spreadsheet is not the same thing as a paper spreadsheet because paper spreadsheets aren't intelligent. When you change one number in one box, the other numbers don't change.
True.
So the person who comes up with VisiCalc, which was at least the first one I'm familiar with, suppose that at that time it had not been clear that that software was outside patent, which well, what people thought it was. So the person who comes up with VisiCalc applies for a patent for the idea of having a computer program set up so that you have an apparent spreadsheet on the screen, you can put in the cells formulas related to other cells, and it automatically updates as you change information. Clearly a very important mm-hmm. invention. Is that patentable under the EPO rules?
Okay, so according from kind of what I've read, the... According to the rules, if you read them strictly, then no, it's not patentable. But the practice of the EPO is very different, and yes, it would probably be granted. They've been far more liberal than the rules would suggest that they should be. And so, would you in fact get a patent? Probably.
So what should Kenya do? What should the rule in Kenya be?
Okay, so...
I'm assuming that Kenya is a net consumer of IP.
Certainly.
But expects to be a significant producer as well.
Right. So my conclusion for what the developing country should do is what I've also read is that when there are broad changes to the IP laws or any of the rules, in fact, regarding the WTO, is that developed countries really come at these developing countries pretty hard to enforce them properly. But when there are narrower limitations put on in these rules, then... You know, there isn't as much of a reason to go in and force through the WTO mechanisms, sanctions or any other coercive measures. So what I kind of suggest is that developing countries, at least that are planning on developing a knowledge economy, should identify, depending on the size of the country, certain number of sectors, strategic sectors that they want to develop. And then they should put my proposed limitations on or modification to their patent system, but only for those specific sectors. So here I'm focused on computer software, so if Kenya wanted to do that, they should use what I suggest, which is what New Zealand does, which is they limit inventions strictly for computer programs by saying they are not, in fact, inventions.
So what you're really saying is that you want them to not protect what they're producing on the grounds that what they're producing is going to conflict with patents that other people have already produced. Is that right?
Only up until the point that they are able to compete on the global market. So at this point, they're not able to.
But why should they ever? That is, if I understand the situation correctly, suppose they follow your rule.
Yeah.
That won't keep them from enforcing patents in the U.S. on software, will it? Because the U.S. does define software as
right.
invention.
Right. That's right.
So that why shouldn't they forever? Why isn't the sensible thing for any country to do, assuming the country doesn't want to protect its own IP against its own citizens, supposing it doesn't want that,
right.
which may be... Then why isn't the sensible strategy for every country to define things in such a way that that foreign IP is not protected in that country, and its IP is protected in other countries? Isn't that the obvious best strategy?
Okay, so I guess what I would say is that's kind of what every country does anyways. It's just they are less able to through the WTO because it kind of sets thresholds on everything that you're supposed to do. So I'm saying that a country should do it in a very limited way for a very particular parts of their economy, not for their whole economy, which is what countries in the past have tried to do.
Does Kenya pay IP fees for the use of pharmaceuticals or for the use of agricultural technology?
I have not looked into those numbers for Kenya specifically.
So I would be surprised if they didn't. That's why
they did not. Okay.
If they were, at least we're not supposed to.
Oh, right, right.
The question I'm really asking is it really true that it's more important to avoid IP in the areas in what you're describing, the areas you're developing, as opposed to avoiding IP in the much larger areas that you're already doing, that you're already consuming?
Yeah. Well, so the problem with a country like Kenya, though, so let's use agriculture equipment. Because obviously they're going to be importing a lot of that. If they blocked, how do we say this?
They blocked enforcement of patents on agricultural technology, which I assume some of which must exist. I don't know how important they are.
Yeah, exactly.
Or pharmaceutical would certainly doesn't.
Pharmaceuticals exist. Would probably be more important, but they're probably going to be the number.
I'm also not sure I understand for a moment. I'm not sure I understand your proposal even for software. Because for a moment, the reason that a software developer in Kenya wants weak patent protection in Kenya is that he wants to be able to produce software and then export it. But he's not going to be able to get a patent in the U.S. on that software because the U.S. will say the existing software is an invention.
But he doesn't need the patent in the United States, does he? He needs it in Kenya. So because
Kenya's a tiny market.
Well, right, but that would be if...
No one is going to be doing software development in Kenya for Kenya.
Well, of course not, but nobody... Well, I suppose I shouldn't say nobody. When I think of the software market, I don't think of the traditionally distributed CD market anymore. I think of the Internet market.
That's fine.
For software. And for the Internet software market, you don't really... You need to protect your property where it's, I guess, deployed, right? And so if they can get around the licensing and all that.
So suppose you're in Kenya and you create an app for the iPhone.
Yeah.
That seems like a reasonable example of what you're describing.
Absolutely.
And the app for your iPhone violates the patent as the U.S. interpreter of some existing patent holder.
Mm-hmm.
What good does it do you that Kenya doesn't believe his patent is valid? You're not breaking Kenyan law, but aren't you subject to penalties for breaking U.S. law for selling to U.S. people in the U.S.? They may not be able to enforce it, but they couldn't enforce it if you were breaking Kenyan law either.
Well, I guess for the time being, yeah, you are breaking the law, the U.S. law, when you're importing that. But at this point, I don't really know if there's a way to limit the import.
Maybe there isn't, but I don't see how much better off you are because you're not breaking Kenyan law. Are you is what you're worried about that people in the U.S., that the U.S. copyright holder will say, well, I can't in practice enforce, or more patent holder, I can't enforce my rights by stopping people from downloading stuff from the internet. So I'll go to Kenya and get an injunction from a Kenyan court to shut him down.
Right. Yeah.
That's exactly what you're targeting.
I'm sorry, yeah.
All right. I just wanted to make it clear what you were getting out of this.
I should make that more clear. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's see if we now understand it. What you want to do is to construct the rules in such a way that you can engage in foreign piracy, as it were, that is foreign distribution of products that violate foreign IP law under foreign laws, but do it without violating your IP laws at home, in order that they can't get the courts at home to shut you down.
Right.
Because they can't, in practice, enforce their own law in their own country.
Exactly.
Very interesting. All right. Other people's comments? I shouldn't be hogging all of this. Two people. Yeah.
Okay. In the meantime, should they be sort of participating in the push for the development agenda with WIPO, do you think?
I mean, they could, but from what I understand about WIPO and the development agenda at WIPO, it's not really going anywhere because the rich countries don't want it to. The poor countries have all the power because of the number of votes, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, they could.
So what's happening in WIPO? Tell the rest of us about it. This is an insider conversation. So,
To be honest, as soon as I saw that it's not really going anywhere, I stopped investigating it.
So what is it?
It's basically just it's sort of almost like an advocacy campaign to give to loosen up on restrictions if people want to be in TRIPS, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So it would. It's just more of a push. Like you said, it's not really going anywhere as far as having teeth, but they're pushing for, we'll sort of possibly sign on to your stricter rules if we can get, if we can not have to follow them for 20 years or something like that. So sort of weaning off the old way into...
And there's already kind of stuff like that in the WTO stuff.
Yeah.
That, I mean, it basically, they don't have to enforce these laws until like 2015.
So I guess the other question that I've wondered about, and I just don't know enough about it in practice, is what prevents countries from signing all the agreements and just never enforcing the rules? That after all, the Kenyan police are hired by Kenya, not by the U.S. The Kenyan courts are staffed by Kenya, not the U.S. So what prevents a country which wants whatever the advantages are of signing treaties,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't want the costs of abiding by those treaties from simply signing it? There's this famous line from an ugly bit of U.S. history, the Chief Justice has made his law, now let him enforce it. By the president.
Right.
So what's to prevent Kenya or India, for that matter, from de facto not applying the law and de jure lying? What are the restrictions?
So that's actually been a big problem in China. And
tell me about this. I think I've got at least one copyrighted work in China. I might make some money out of it.
Well, so it's the example that I've read in China, it has to do mostly with fashion.
Yes.
And so what actually ends up happening is that American or foreign companies that own the, the IP that's being pirated, they basically hire private firms to go knock heads together, enforce it themselves privately. Now, it's frowned upon by the Chinese government and police, but they don't stop them either, usually. So usually it's just a private enforcement. So what would stop?
Enforce how? What can they do?
They
shoot people? They burn factories? do we know?
Yes. a lot of nasty things. But usually it's just confiscating the goods or accidents happen.
How can you confiscate goods without a court saying you can?
Well, the police look the other way. Because it's something they should be doing, but they're not.
Uh-huh.
So unless it's specifically state sanctioned, like if it's at a state factory, right, you're not going to go do it.
Yeah.
But if it's at a private factory that they have usually been looking the other way, they'll keep looking the other way when it's done. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, I just wanted to add a little to that conversation. To be cynical about it, there's pretty much nothing at the ground level that another country can do to make a country physically confiscate or do this and that. What they have been successful at least, even though it's, it might not provide much relief, is getting the country's laws changed to be consistent with the rules of the trade.
But there is still another alternative, but I don't know if it happens. And the other alternative would be they could say the treaty says you've got to do X. Your law is doing X, but on the ground you're not doing X, so we'll do whatever we would do for a violation of the treaty, so that we will say, all right, part of what you got out of signing this was free trade with the U.S., so we're going to put up tariffs against you now, because we're going to say you're in violation. Does that actually happen?
Yes, it does happen, and it doesn't only happen against developed countries. The U.S. has had judgments against it many times, and no.
And do the judgments actually...
We ignore them because we can't.
But we say,
but Kenya couldn't ignore
them. But you say we ignore them. But the question is, does the judgment actually mean that another country stops giving us whatever benefit we were getting under the treaty we're breaking?
No. They keep trading with us because they make so much money. But if it were Kenya, on the other hand... So I think the example where the WTO actually has brought judgment against the United States was in reference to agricultural subsidies, and the action was brought, I think, if I remember correctly, by Brazil. But Brazil sells airplanes to us, too. So they're not going to give up trade in aircraft for sugar. But Kenya, on the other hand, doesn't have that same kind of relationship with the United States. So the U.S. could presumably use its trading power to that effect, essentially sanctioning it through the WTO.
Has it ever?
I'm not sure.
The process takes so long that it's honestly it's of little relief to any actual plaintiff in this situation. They can, and first of all, they'd have to lobby the U.S. to file a complaint because they can't do it on their own. If the U.S. does it, then it becomes this lengthy, years-long process. And even then, if they say your laws aren't in compliance with our rules, then that country gets X amount of time to change their laws.
But I'm not interested in laws not in compliance. I'm interested in enforcement not in compliance.
It's such a thing that you're basically forced to do self-help and try to enforce it on your own through private agencies.
So why does the U.S. sign these? Why does anybody bother negotiating these treaties if they have no effect?
Well, they do generally have an effect. I mean, in most things, most countries do what's right. No,
that's a bizarre view of the world you have.
No, right? I'm not that cynical. but, no, in reality, most of these treaties do have some of their intended effect.
I'm partly wondering how it interacts with the internal politics of the country. If part of what's going on is that you have a country where there are, I mean, in Japan, clearly there are people who have IP. In India, there are people who have some substantial amounts of IP. Bollywood was mentioned earlier. So maybe somehow what the treaty does is to make it easier for the people within the country to apply pressure to get laws enforced, given the laws of the past. I don't know.
Probably,
I'm just,
yes, yeah.
All of this.
I mean, there's probably, that is definitely a factor, I'm sure.
Anyway.
Any more questions?
Great, we get to hear about tattoos next. I know that was a fun topic. But you haven't done proper research. I don't see any tattoos.
I'm planning on getting a smiley face one on the bottom of my foot with my boyfriend. That will give my mom a heart attack. But, so, in general, I kind of came up with this tattoo paper concept idea after watching the show, where there's this... there's these people in Vegas that have the ugliest tattoos, and there's this one lady who had one of a very sexual body part on men that I should not announce in class. And she wanted that tattoo removed or kind of fixed a little bit. There's this show, I think America's Worst Tattoos or something that comes on TV, and the guy changed that tattoo into this beautiful mural of an owl. I don't know how he did that, but it was pretty amazing. But then I thought, okay, wait a minute. Well, what if the person who drew that tattoo on the girl had some IP rights over it? And then I figured, okay, let's do this article. And I found this one where this girl from Singapore, she actually had this original design of a lacy black bow. And she found that someone had copied it and posted pictures of her tattoo on Instagram from Malaysia. So Singapore and Malaysia, they're covered with a Berne Treaty, and they're pretty much battling it out over who has copyright rights over that particular design. So in essence, since all of you guys have supposedly already read my paper, what I pretty much discuss is how that you can have a copyright protection, which is the best way to enforce tattoo infringement. But there's also some opportunities for trademark protection, like the Playboy Enterprise has trademarked the rabbit head logo. And then you also have some opportunities to do to provide patent protection for it. But the problem with providing patent protection, and this is something that I would love some input on from all of you, is that so there's temporary tattoo products like this under eye black tattoo that can be patented because it's a product, but patenting the idea or like a tattoo design is a lot more difficult because it's not a process or a procedure. So one thing that the professor asked is, imagine what would qualify as an idea rather than an expression in this field. And I was hoping some of you guys, if you guys have any hypothetical ideas, that you can...
So stop for a moment. It's a good question. Mm-hmm. Can anybody propose a imaginary tattoo which could plausibly claim that it implemented, that it embodied in a patentable idea?
Couldn't you just patent the charts associated with a patent?
Yeah, like a schematic?
Yeah. Like, you know, the front page of a patent has the flow charts or whatever.
Yeah.
The images associated with the cross.
Patent or copyright? I understand, but the front page of a patent, how do you patent the front page of a patent?
No. You would get in the image that you would tattoo would be the flow charts of the patent.
And then how is that image now protected by patent?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood.
The question is, it seems plausible that you could copyright a tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
A tattoo looks like an expression.
Right.
Is there any way that a tattoo could be an idea? Is there any way that you could come up with something in the tattooing art, as it were, which you could, because I've already thought of one obscene answer, which I'm not sure I will give you, but other people can think of the question of ideas of things you could do with tattoos where what you're copywriting is not the particular picture, but the clever idea embodied in that picture.
You could have a QR code. If you invented a new kind of QR code that somebody could scan your arm and get a picture pop up on their phone, you could try to patent that as a kind of a process, or if it needed a mechanical.
So your idea now is that you patent the idea of having a QR code on your body that people will... the tattoo is a part of what you're doing. I don't know, I mentioned to you, I was mentioning to somebody at Google a couple of days ago that I believe the killer app for Google Glass is the Farley file. Did I discuss that here?
Yeah.
I did. Anyway, but you can imagine, the Farley file is the file that you look at somebody, it does face recognition, and it tells you what you ought to know about that person. So for all of us who are terrible at remembering names, not only would I look at somebody I'd met once 2 years ago and immediately see his name, but I also remember the conversation we had and could therefore make it look as though he was really important to me by what I said. But you could imagine that I'm not sure it's worth doing, that you could have a tattoo which you point your cell phone at of somebody else, and it gives you whatever information he wants you to have about him. All right, that in fact exists in World of Warcraft. There is a add-on in World of Warcraft, which I haven't used, but my daughter has used, in which you basically have some extra information about your character, and people who also have the add-ons, when they look at your character, can see that information. So that's one possible use of a tattoo in a plausibly patented process. Other ideas? The kind of idea I was thinking of was a tattoo which somehow exploited body shapes to be two different things. So the one I was imagining was a tattoo around the mouth that made it into a vagina. That was my obscene suggestion. But you could imagine other things along the similar lines where you say a tattoo such that it's one picture with your arms out and then a different picture when your arms come in, and therefore the part of the tattoo on your body gets united with the part on your arms. Or a tattoo which looks different with your eyes open and your eyes closed. All right, but that's not a bad idea. A tattoo so people won't know that you're asleep, because the tattoo on the outside of your eyelids is a tattoo of your eye.
I've actually seen that. It's really creepy.
Does it really exist? Yes.
Yeah, it's really creepy.
Evidence that however crazy your idea is, somebody's done it. but anyway, but it seems to me that family of things in principle is an interesting answer to your question. You could imagine cases where there is an eye, because in my case, I'm not patenting the tattoo of the eye, I'm patenting the idea of a tattoo of an eye.
Okay.
And I'm not patenting the particular picture in which when I'm standing like this, we see a picture of heaven. And when I stand like this, it turns into a picture of hell, if you think of sort of tricks people can do with art. When my hands are open, this is a forest, and when they're closed, it's a picture of my girlfriend. You can imagine things like that being patented, right?
Yeah.
That works.
Absolutely.
All right.
And then, again, so as you guys probably noticed, there's not a lot of case precedent for tattoo cases.
But you have to realize the background of this is that when I was your age, nobody in this room would have had a tattoo. All right, that from my standpoint, both tattoos and body piercings, except for earrings, mm-hmm. are this weird behavior pattern, which only crazy people or people from very much outside the sort of normal society engaged in when I was 20 or 30, and which has now become normal.
I wouldn't think that's true, because, I mean, there's henna tattoos that date...
That's a different culture. That's not my culture. Oh, absolutely. No, the use of... I don't know if I call them tattoos, but the use of henna... In the Islamic culture, and I guess maybe in non-Islamic India, I'm not sure, in Hindu India as well, has sort of been a standard part of it for certainly more than 1,000 years, probably longer than that, but not in America. I mean, that was something foreigners did, you know. So the sense in which your paper might not be entirely just a joke, I mean, it might actually be relevant at some point, is that this is something which didn't really exist in terms of our legal culture a few decades ago, has become very common now, extraordinarily common from my standpoint. In fact, I'm a little surprised I'm not seeing any tattoos looking around the room, but I guess law students are a little on the conservative side, so all your tattoos are hidden under your clothing. And therefore might actually raise serious legal issues, you know, in the next few decades. So it's, and as I've said before, one of the places you want to look for doing original ideas is new issues, new things mm-hmm. that weren't around. So continue anyway.
Okay. All right. Let's see. There was also, in general, another issue that I had with my paper was that with trademark cases in particular. So one issue that you actually brought up to me is the trademarking logos for sports teams. And I talked a little bit about putting that onto different articles of clothing, and also the trademarks for jewelry designs that people have copied and tattoo designs that they've used on prospective clients and things like that. One of the issues with that is you don't know if you don't know if the trademark is the design itself. I'm so sorry. I'm totally messing this up. I'm a little frazzled. But essentially, the issue is we don't know who owns the copyright. Would it be the person who designs it? Would it be the owner of the store who hired this person who designed the tattoo? Or would it be the person who actually owns the body? Get some discussion and dialogue here and see... Like, what do you guys think would be most appropriate if you were kind of enforcing a tattoo? And there's some language on exactly what can be enforced somewhere here. I believe it is in the second to last paragraph on enforcing copyright. Jenny.
I guess for enforcing trademarks in tattoos, mm-hmm. I guess the essential issue of trademark is consumer confusion, right? But if I have, like, the SF Giants tattoo on my arm, no one's going to get confused that I'm, like, part of the SF Giants versus...
You could imagine, suppose the law does give them protection, and the SF Giants could say, if you make a sufficient donation, or if you buy a season ticket, part of the deal in the season ticket is that we will allow you to tattoo on the middle of your forehead the SF Giants logo. And then they say, when you, the pirate tattoo operator, tattoo that logo on people's forehead, you're cutting into our revenue. So obviously it's a... That this goes back, in a sense, there's a really two different issues here. One of them is the confusion, and the other is the other argument for trademark, which is that it's a revenue source. And the revenue source, it seems to me, you could certainly make that case, and the confusion is a little bit harder unless they actually do have such a program. But
yeah, in general, the main argument was that they would think that maybe you're a sponsor or you're associated with the team in some way, shape, or form. And if you were, say, on a cover of a magazine, then people might be calling you and be like, oh, how are you affiliated with the SF Giants or something like that? And that was something that they, of course, didn't want, and that's one of the biggest issues with sports logos.
I guess on the other side, it's also like...
That's true. It has been used. That's what they do with the Playboy logo. They use it for advertising purposes, and that's why they trademarked that logo. Kendall?
Yeah, so with regards, I'm actually writing a paper talking about use of trademarks in expressive works, and in the courts actually recognize that as long as something is not commercial speech, which not all of it, I think you could conceive of a situation which a tattoo could be considered commercial speech, but for the most part, it's going to be considered non-commercial speech. And most of the courts use either the Rogers and Transformative Use Test, and they find that as long as there's some sort of artistic relevance to the use of the trademark, it's not a violation of the trademark holder's rights. So I think with tattoos, because there is that expressive nature, there could be issues with a trademark holder trying to assert rights beyond just whether it's likelihood of confusion. I think there could also be issues with, well, it could also be considered artistic. I think the copyright is a better... I actually just sent you an article because I think you'll find it interesting. But I mean, I think that copyright may be the stronger... argument with tattoos.
Oh, most definitely. I agree. Yeah.
Did you go over the work for hire issues and the factors?
I briefly went over it. I didn't go over that in much detail because
essentially then, even if it doesn't qualify as a work for hire, the tattoo itself, the person will still have the property interest over. Mm-hmm. However, the tattooist will actually own the copyright on that. So they can't then go and say, oh, I want this, but on my other arm of another tattoo artist. But technically they might be able to, because it would technically be different.
But I was also wondering in that context, if you believe in moral rights, can you erase the tattoo without the permission of the artist? If you're in a country, if you're in a place which enforces moral rights in IP, because I think it's the case, though I'm not sure, am I right that in Europe I don't have an automatic right to destroy a painting that I've bought? So therefore, what the conflict, as it were, between the artist and the canvas, can I erase a tattoo or can I alter a tattoo if it's under European law? Anybody?
My instinct would be that, from a policy standpoint, I don't think we should treat the human body the same way that we would treat a canvas. I think that having a painting in your house, you can do something else with the painting other than destroy it. Give it to another person.
But now my next case is, suppose I've got a artistic mural on a building. Am I allowed to tear the building down? That seems to be analogous in that I've got a good reason to destroy it, because if I don't destroy it, I can't build a new building there.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that's analogous, because, I mean, my friends, they've gotten lots of tattoos, and their tattoos over time, they actually change. Like, some of them, the images have become completely deformed, disfigured, and it looks really bad. So in that sense, if the tattoo is going to evolve over time as you, like, grow and shrink and as your body is...
But, of course, the mural might also change over time, as you know, through weathering and colors fading and stuff like that. So I'm not sure that really, really affects it. And modifying the tattoo would be another case, right? Suppose, in fact, that's even under U.S. law, right? Suppose I've got a tattoo, and I say, well, wouldn't it be really neat if I embedded that tattoo in a larger tattoo? Mm-hmm. Well, is that a derivative work? And if so, do I need permission from the first tattoo artist to do it?
I think it turns on whether or not it's transformative. Because the most recent copyright cases that came out look towards the transformativeness. So when you had a person that took pictures of the Rastafarians that case. What was it called? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there was a case where this photographer went to this very uninhabited area and took these beautiful pictures of these Rastafarians, and he basically put them together in a book and then sold the book. Well, another artist then bought the book, tore the pictures out, and used them as a collage of artwork, and they actually viewed that. Most of the works were viewed as transformative, and the artist that actually tore the pages out and used it in artwork sold his artwork for millions of dollars a piece, and the book he bought for $20.
With the Myrtle, we actually have rights to the German and the Royal, I think. So you can't just let it be in a very kind of reckless way. So in that case, body changes rapidly, like somebody came out of the room or something, and in that case, it's kind of analogous to letting.
Yeah, I wondered actually about the case of either gaining or losing weight, whether if that changed the appearance of the tattoo, if the artist could then claim that you were either creating a derivative work or violating his moral rights.
That would be so ridiculous.
Yes. You surely aren't going to say that legal rules are never ridiculous.
Well, it's okay. We don't enforce moral rights.
That's right. But derivative works we do enforce.
That's true. There goes that idea of the smiley face tattoo. What if my foot grows? I hope not.
And you've got to be careful. You can't go around barefoot because you might wear it off.
That's true. All right, no more tattoos.
But another thing, going back to the idea that it could work as advertisers when you use people, companies' logos, it could actually go the other way and deplete the dominant. Because let's say you have a lot of other sports teams fans, they're constantly getting to fights, and then now this team has a reputation for somebody else, or they have a tramp stamp, right, position. So let's say the Playboy logo has been used all the time in that area, and then you've got a lot of women who don't look so nice or whatever the image Playboy wants, sporting that. Wouldn't their image also kind of be depleted with that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. But I mean, see, the other problem with this tattoo issue is that it's so difficult to enforce. And I mean, a tramp stamp, it's not usually visible to a lot of people. So how would they find out about it, and how would that affect their marketing strategies if it's not in a very openly visible area, unless they're on like all these porn sites, a lot of ugly porn stars, and they're displaying their tramp stamp there.
So I know there's one kind of, I can't really call him like a superstar, but there's a professional wrestler who's kind of like up there, so very visible, and he has a big Pepsi, his name is CM Punk, so you want to look him up, but he has a very big one there, and a lot of times when promotional posters, they have to kind of like shade it out so it doesn't really look like Pepsi. Or I think when they do the wrestling video games, they like take that part out. So here he is. He's very visible. WWE is making money off of him. He's making money off with his kind of his character is like it's like straight edge where they would drink him with alcohol and drugs. But I guess they use tattoos a lot. And so it's kind of a thing that he thinks this does. So I think there's a lot of things that he's kind of
thing. So he's using his body to kind of market the tattoo product.
Right, because everything they do is an image.
But presumably Pepsi is not paying him to do this.
No, it doesn't seem like it. And I think he got this when he was one of those interview wrestlers where he wasn't up to
One other point which occurs to me, sort of as a very general point, is that you can argue that the reason that we got copyright law was the printing press. That is, that as long as it's expensive to make copies, you don't really much need copyright law.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't have a printing press for tattoos at this point, at least not for real tattoos. So maybe the real answer is we don't need IP for it because reproduction is costly. in which case you might still want IP for the fake tattoos. I don't know what they're called, but they're the things, you know, which you peel off and put on you and look like a tattoo, but then they come off again. And for those, you could argue that those are covered by ordinary copyright law because they're in the same category. But it is worth at least thinking if you were imagining that your paper is going to be a theoretical paper asking, when we pass the tattoo protection statute, I wonder, you think some congressman...
They passed it in a couple countries.
Is a congressman from Las Vegas the person you want to approach on this project? But when you pass the tattoo protection statute, one of the arguments you'll have to face is we don't really need IP because each tattoo is an individual work of art. And now I guess you could say, well, we don't need to protect against people photographing your IP and copying that, but that may not be a big issue. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if you thought about this at all, but somewhere very common. Sometimes tattoos take longer to create than one sitting. So my old roommate actually had a half-finished tattoo covering her shoulders, and she had an artist who basically outlined the whole design and then filled in about half of it, and then she moved to another state, and she can't get another tattoo artist to finish the artwork because they don't want to violate someone else's work. So I don't know if you thought at all about the long process that can occur in creating tattoos, like really elaborate ones. I don't know if that triggers anything for you. But
I didn't actually even realize that because I've never gotten a tattoo, and I don't really know many friends that have big ones, but that's a really cool case.
Yeah.
You need to add something about my type of
tattoo. I said you've been US Time Medical.
The what tattoo? What tattoo?
Mike Tyson has a tattoo on his face, and in the movie The Hangover 2, another character gets really drunk and passes out and gets an identical tattoo. Mm-hmm. And after the movie came out, original tattoo artist actually sued Warner Brothers, saying you violated my copyright by showing a copy of my tattoo on someone else's face. And they ultimately settled. But there's a New York Times article that I had for another research project I was doing that really talked about the legal issues and a lot of copyright stuff. It's really, really good.
So it's becoming a real issue.
Yeah, it's happened.
Everything has happened. All right. Thanks, everybody.